Welcome everyone. I know it's bright and early in the new year. This course will be on the standard model. I just want to introduce myself, or maybe reintroduce myself, because I gave a short talk last year. I'm Sean Tulin, so here we go. So the standard model is basically the periodic table of elementary particles and forces, and it describes all of the fundamental interactions of particles that we've thus far discovered in the laboratory. Let me first write down a reference book, if you're interested in that. So a nice textbook on the standard model is called Gauge Theory. Of elementary particles. Elementary particle physics. And it's by Cheng and Li. We're not going to be following the textbook too closely, but I just mention it because it's very nice, although it's fairly old. But OK, there you go. So during the first class, we're going to try to cover all of the standard model, kind of in a sort of superficial way. But I just want to introduce everything, just so you're familiar with what all the particles are. And I apologize if you're already familiar with the standard model. This lecture might be a little bit boring, but let's go through it. So the standard model is composed of both fermions and bosons. So let's talk about those. So we have fermions. Which all of the fermions in the standard model are spin 1/2. So I'll just give you their names. What is the mass? And the electric charge. In units of E, where E is equal to the proton charge. So to start with, we have quarks. So there are six types. There's up, which is the U quark. There's charm, which is the C quark. And then there's top, which is T. And the approximate masses are around 2 MeV. Let's see, 1.3 GeV and 173 GeV. And all three of these quarks have charge 2/3 times E. Then we have the down quark, D, the strange quark, S, and the bottom quark, B. And their masses are approximately 5 MeV, 95 MeV, and around 4.2 GeV. And all of these quarks have charge minus 1/3 times E. OK, then we have the leptons. And to start out, we have the charged leptons. We have the electron, the muon, and the tau. And the masses are approximately 511 keV, 106 MeV, and 1.8 GeV. And all of these have charge minus E. And last, we have the neutrinos. So they come in two types, the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino. And the masses are not zero, but they're very small. So I'll just write approximately zero. And what I mean by this is less than of order an electron volt. And at the moment, we don't know exactly what their masses are. And in fact, these are not even the mass eigenstates. But in the standard model, typically what you do is you assume that neutrinos are massless. The electric charge of the neutrinos is zero. So the standard model, as I mentioned, is defined as having massless neutrinos. They are not massless. But there are two ways in which we can include masses for neutrinos, and we're just not sure which one is the correct one at the moment. All right? So for the time being, we'll just set the masses to be zero. All right. So those are the fermions. And then we have bosons, which can either have spin 0 or 1. So first, we have the gauge bosons, which are spin 1. We have the photon, which is massless and has zero charge. The photon, is, of course, the mediator of the electromagnetic force. We have the gluon, which is the mediator of the strong force, which is also massless and has zero electric charge. We have the W, and there's two types, one with plus and one with minus charge, which are mediators of the weak force. And the mass of the W is around 80.4 GeV. And the charges are plus or minus E. And then there's also the Z, which is also one of the mediators of the weak force. The mass is 91.2 GeV, and it is neutral. And then lastly, we have the Higgs boson. Which is spin 0. All right, so call it H. And the mass is around 125 GeV, and it is also neutral, like so. OK, so these are all of the particles in the standard model. In the standard model, forces are mediated by gauge bosons. Probably you know. So the most familiar one is just the electromagnetic force, mediated by the photon. And of course, the photon couples to electric charge. And so the theory of electromagnetism is called QED, which is just quantum field theory of the electron and the photon. All right, so you have in QED, of course, Feynman rules, Feynman diagrams that look like this. And it gives rise to a potential between, for example, electrons or electrons and positrons, which takes the following form. It could be attractive or negative, and we have a coupling constant, alpha over R. OK, so that's probably the most familiar one, the electromagnetic force. Then we have other forces as well. So next we have the strong force, which is mediated by the gluon. And the gluon couples two particles with color. So of course, color is like the non-abelian analog of electric charge. There's three types of color. We call them red, green, and blue. And there's also three types of anticolor, which you would write as anti-red, anti-green, and anti-blue. So I'll just call it R bar, G bar, and B bar, like so. So then the idea is that quarks will carry color, and then anti-quarks will carry anti-color. So a quark field Q will be a triplet under color. And the components will just be the red, green, and blue, a vector in color space like this. And then an antiquark, Q bar, will be a vector as well, but carrying anticolor, like so. All right. So the big difference between the strong force and the electromagnetic force is that for electromagnetism, the photon doesn't carry its own charge. The photon is neutral. But for the strong force, the gluon itself is charged. It carries color. And in fact, it carries both color and anticolor. So the gluons carry both color and anticolor. So for example, they would have color assignments of like R, G bar, for example, or G, B bar, etc. Now you might guess that there's 9 combinations that you can write down. So there should be 9 gluons, but that's not quite correct. There's actually 8. So there's 8 gluons. Corresponding to the 8 combinations you can write down for both color and anticolor. And the reason that one of them is missing is that when you form a linear combination of R, R bar, G, G bar, and B, B bar, that combination actually doesn't carry any color at all. If you're familiar with group theory, that combination is a singlet. And so you can separate that one out from the remaining 9 that you would naively have, leaving 8. All right. So similar to QED, there's also Feynman rules. So you have, first of all, the QED-like Feynman rule, where you have the gluon interacting with quarks, quark antiquark. Here, Q is any flavor of quark, U, C, T, D, S, B. And it's always the same type on both legs. But now the new feature, of course, of the non-abelian gauge theory, which is the color, corresponding to color, is that you have additional Feynman rules, where the gluon can also interact with the gluons, because the gluons themselves carry color. And so you have diagrams like these, and a 4-point diagram like so. And again, there's no analogous diagrams like these in QED because the photon doesn't carry electric charge. So it turns out that these diagrams are very important. They modify the potential that quarks feel compared to what they would feel if color was just an abelian theory, like electromagnetism. So you can think about what is the potential between a quark and an antiquark. So there's some other coupling constant. And at short distances, it looks very similar to electromagnetism. It is just a Coulomb potential. So let me draw by the dotted line a Coulomb potential, like so. And then at short distances, it follows the Coulomb potential, like this. But then something else happens at large distances. At large distances, or at low energies, you probably know, due to asymptotic freedom, the interaction gets stronger and stronger. So instead of just having this, there's another term, which grows linearly with R. And so there's some constant times radius like this. And so the potential grows. So what this means is that it takes an infinite amount of energy to separate two quarks to infinity. Separate a quark and an antiquark. What this means is that there are no free quarks. And so this is a feature known as confinement. So all quarks and antiquarks must be confined. And that means they must only exist as bound states. They don't exist by themselves. And those bound states are known as hadrons. So they must be confined. Into hadrons. Hadrons can come in two forms. There are mesons and baryons. And the reason it only comes in those forms is those are the only linear combinations of quarks and antiquarks you can form in which the object has net color neutral. So these bound states must be neutral under color. They must be color neutral, also known as, you can also call this as white. So the meson, for example, is a Q quark antiquark pair. And for example, you can have color, and the corresponding anticolor will give you something that's neutral. So R, R bar will give you something that's quote unquote white. Or neutral under color. Alternately, you can have baryons, Q, Q, Q. And for example, RGB, when you bring all of the different colors together, this is also neutral. Like so. Okay, so those are the combinations you can have. You can also have antibarons as well. You have three antiquarks. So,
what about the top quark? It doesn't bond in bond state, does it?
Yeah, the top quark's actually a good counterexample. It is a free quark in a sense. It doesn't form hadrons because it decays before it hadronizes. So effectively, you can compute everything you want to know about the top quark, assuming that it doesn't confine at all, treating it as a free quark. OK. All right. So you probably know this already, but let's just go through it. The proton is an example of a baryon. It's made out of U, U, and D. And the neutron is also a baryon, of course. It's U, D, D. And then the total charge, of course, is just the sum of the electric charges of the individual quarks. And so the charge of the proton would just be 2 times 2/3 E, and then plus 1 times minus 1/3 E just gives you E, so the proton charge. And then for the neutron, it's the same thing. You just have 2/3 E plus 2 times minus 1/3 E gives you 0. OK. So these are the proton and neutron charges, straightforward to compute. All right. So so that's the strong force in 5 minutes. Now we're just going to move on to the weak interaction, or the weak force. Okay. So for electromagnetism, only particles with electric charge coupled to the photon. For the strong force, only quarks and gluons, which carry color, coupled to the strong force. For the weak force, all fermions are involved in the weak force. And so here, let me just write down the Feynman rules. We have the Z boson, which couples to any fermion F. But it's always the same one going in as coming out. Doesn't change the type of fermion. Then you have the W. So I'll write the W plus here as going in like this. And then we have quarks, let's say. So if you have a W plus going in, it will change a down type quark to an up type quark. So you would have like a D, an S, or a B getting changed to a U, a C, or T. The W also interacts with the leptons. So again, if you have a W plus, it can convert a charged lepton, like the electron, the muon, or the tau, to the corresponding neutrino, like so. The interactions of the W minus are exactly the same, just reverse the directions of the arrow. The interactions of the W are very unique because it's only the W that changes the type of fermion involved. Another way to say it is if it were not for the W boson, all of the fermions in the standard model would be stable because they could never change from one type to the other. So the fact that many of these fermions are unstable, is due to the W. So I can just write down some examples of that. Go over here. So weak decays are decays through the W boson that change fermions from one type to another. And I can write down some examples. You might be familiar with muon decay, where you have a muon getting converted into a muon neutrino and a W. And so it has to be a W minus. And then this will go to an electron and an electron antineutrino. Now, of course, the muon is only around 100 MeV. The W boson is much, much heavier, but it's off-shell, so that's fine. Another example of a weak decay is neutron beta decay. So in this, you have a neutron, which is a UDD. Gets converted into a proton, UDU, where one of the down quarks gets converted into the up quark through the W. So this would have to be W minus again, and then it would go to an electron and electron antineutrino, like so. And again, the mass difference between the neutron and the proton electron neutrino system is only of order an MeV, so the W is, again, off shell in this process. Okay, so that's in a nutshell, in a very small nutshell, what all of the particles in the standard model are and sort of roughly what their roles are. And so the goal for the first week or so of class will be to write down the Lagrangian that describes all of those particles and all of their interactions. Let's see. All right, so let's write down what the goal is. To get the Lagrangian of the standard model. And the key ingredients here will be gauge theory, or gauge symmetry, and renormalizability. The reason we want a renormalizable theory, of course, is that we want the theory to be predictive. If it's not renormalizable, then it's not predictive. So there's no point. The reason we want a gauge symmetry is just an experimental fact. We've observed gauge bosons, and so we want to write down the theory that describes them. I also should mention that the goal of writing down the Lagrangian of the standard model is not going to be the ultimate Lagrangian of the universe, because there are many ingredients that we're not going to be including here. We're not going to be including neutrino masses. We're not going to be including dark matter. We're not going to be including dark energy. We're not going to be including the quantum mechanics of gravity. So all of those things are just going to be missing ingredients, which we'll sweep under the rug for the rest of the course. All right. So one of the principles is gauge symmetry. And you're reasonably familiar with writing down gauge theories. We have electromagnetism. You're familiar with QED. We have quantum chromodynamics. You know how to write down non-abelian gauge theories. But the problem comes in because not all of the spin 1 bosons in the standard model are massless, right? The photon is, the gluon is, but the W and Z are not. So the W and the Z are massive gauge bosons. Another issue is that usually when you write down gauge theories like electromagnetism, quantum chromodynamics, they have what are called vector-like couplings to fermions. So they couple the same way to both the left and right-handed components of the fermion. For the W and the Z, that's no longer the case. They have what are called chiral couplings. They couple differently to the left-handed and right-handed components of those fermions. So this is another problem. So they also have chiral couplings to fermions. This will be another issue. So it turns out that both of these things are inconsistent with the principles that we started with, gauge symmetry and renormalizability. And to illustrate this, I'm just going to write down a simpler theory and just to show you what goes wrong. So I'll just write down a QED-like theory with a massive photon, which I'll call A mu. And it will also have chiral couplings. So here's the Lagrangian. So I'm going to start out with the usual term for the photon field strength tensor. Then I'm going to add a mass term like this. So 1 half ma squared a mu a mu. And then I'm going to include a fermion. So I'll just write down the usual Dirac Lagrangian like so. Psi bar I d slash minus m psi, like this. All right, so we have the field strength tensor. F mu nu is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. Covariant derivative will be d mu minus I g left plus g right p right a mu. So this is what it means to have chiral couplings, that the left and right-handed components will have different coupling constants, G left and G right. So G left and right are the coupling for psi left and psi right. And then the projection operators are just the usual thing. So 1 minus plus gamma 5 over 2. And psi left and right are just the projection operators acting on psi. OK, those are just the definitions. And now let's just consider what happens if we do a gauge transformation. So the field strain tensor, sorry, the field A mu goes to A mu plus D mu and then some function alpha of x. And then the fermions, psi left and right, are also rotated as follows. I get e to the minus I g left right times alpha of x psi. Left, right, like so. OK, so these are just the usual rules for doing a gauge transformation. So now I'm just going to ask which terms are invariant and which ones aren't. So first of all, f mu nu and the covariant derivative term are invariant. OK, so you can check if you don't believe me. Now, which ones aren't? Well, the mass terms are not invariant. So let's start with the mass term for the massive photon. So this one's pretty easy to see. If I just write down a mu, this gets transformed to a mu plus 2 a mu d mu alpha plus d mu alpha squared. OK, so obviously that one is not invariant. Also, the mass term for the fermion, psi bar psi, is also not invariant, as we'll see. So let me write this as psi bar left, psi right, plus psi bar right, psi left. And so now I can just rotate the left and right-handed components separately. And I get that this goes to e to the I g left minus g right, psi bar left, psi right, plus the Hermitian conjugate, which is just e minus I g left minus g right, and then psi bar right, psi left. So this whole thing is not equal to psi bar psi. It's not, unless the couplings happen to be equal. This is what it means to have vector-like couplings. The two couplings are equal to the left and right-handed components. But the standard model is not like this. The W and Z have different couplings to left and right-handed components, so that the mass terms are no longer invariant on the gauge transformation. So you might say, who cares? OK, we have a gauge theory that describes the photon, a gauge theory that describes quantum chromodynamics, the strong force. Let's just give up on having a gauge theory that describes the W and Z. Why not do that? So the reason that's a bad choice is because the theory also becomes non-renormalizable. Okay. So to see this, I need to first consider what the propagator looks like for our massive photon-like vector boson. So first, I just want to remind you what the propagator looks like for the regular photon. So if I write down the propagator, d mu nu x comma y, this is just the time-ordered expectation value of the two fields, a mu x, a nu y, like so. And for a massless photon, you know what the answer is. When you take the Fourier transform of this, you get d mu nu of k is equal to minus I eta mu nu over k squared plus I epsilon. This is for a massless photon. So I just want to show you how it's different when you have a massive photon. There's two differences. One is pretty trivial. You just have to put in the minus ma squared in the denominator. Okay. But the more non-trivial one is how the numerator changes, and so we're going to go through that part. So let's say we have a massive photon. We're just going to compute the same thing. So we're going to use the mode expansion. So I'll just write down what that is. A mu of x is equal to d3k over 2 pi cubed. I have a 1 over 2ek. Then I want to sum over the polarizations, I. And then I have the polarization vectors, e mu I of k. I have annihilation operator, ak. And then e to the minus I k dot x. And then I have plus the Hermitian conjugate. Okay, so this is exactly the same mode expansion operator that you would put in for the photon. The only difference, of course, is that you have three polarizations for our massive photon, not just two. We can have two transverse and also longitudinal. That's going to be the main difference. So now let me just plug in to compute this time-ordered expectation value to compute the Green's function. So let's just compute this one. We have an integral, d3k over 2 pi cubed, 1 over 2ek, d3k prime over 2 pi cubed, 1 over 2ek prime. We have a sum over the polarizations, I and j. So I have e I mu k e j nu k prime. And then I have the expectation value of a k I a k prime j dagger. And then I have e to the minus I k dot x minus k prime dot y. OK. So that's it. That's the only term that's non-zero, because the expectation value is with respect to the vacuum. And so only the A dagger A, or I should say A dagger, will give us something non-zero when we take the vacuum expectation value of that. All right. So this thing you can evaluate in the normal way. You just use the commutation relations for A. And then use the fact that A annihilates the vacuum to get 2EK 2 pi cubed delta 3 k minus k prime times delta ij. So then you can evaluate one of the delta function using the delta function, one of the integrals, and you're just left with the following expression. D3k over 2 pi cubed, 1 over 2 ek, and then I have the sum over the polarization vectors. E mu I k, E j nu k, like so, star. So again, here's the main difference. For the photon, you can replace this sum by minus eta mu nu. But now for a massive photon, we have to revisit this. So let's just compute this thing, this object here, for a massive photon at rest. So there's just three polarizations. They can compute in any, they can be pointed in any of the spatial directions. So you would have E1. Would be, let's say, along the x direction. E2 would be just along the y direction. And E3 would just be pointed along the z direction, like so. So now it's straightforward to compute what this is. It would just be a matrix. Zero. So at rest, of course, means that I should be taking k is equal to zero, equal to the mass, like this. Three momentum is zero here. So this whole thing is just equal to a matrix, 0, 1, 1, 1, mu nu, like so. All right? This is for a photon at rest. So now what we want to do is boost to a non-zero momentum and see what this quantity becomes. So we want to boost to momentum k mu, which is just ek. And then I'll just assume that it's in the z component. So I'll write the three momentum just in the z direction. So I just need to multiply this matrix with the appropriate boost matrix, doing a Lorentz transformation. So this is lambda. And we have gamma, 0, 0, beta gamma. 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0,
beta gamma 0, 0, gamma.
All right, and so gamma and beta are defined in the usual way, Ek over Ma for gamma, and then beta is just K over Ek. All right, so now I'm just going to take this and multiply on both sides by this matrix lambda. So we have this object here. And we're going to boost to this one. This is just lambda times what we had before, 0. 1, 1, 1, and then times lambda. So it's easy just to multiply all those matrices together. Here's what you get. You get k squared over ma squared, 0, 0, and then you get k ek over ma squared. 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, and then you get k ek over ma squared, 0, 0, and then ek squared over ma squared, mu nu. So that's what it is. We can write this in a Lorentz covariant way as follows. So this whole thing is just equal to minus eta mu nu plus k mu k nu over ma squared. So that's writing in a Lorentz covariant way. You can just take the components that you want and see that it's equal to that. So this is the big difference. With the massive photon compared to a massless photon, instead of having eta mu nu, or minus eta mu nu, I should have minus eta mu nu plus k mu k nu over ma squared.
And we cannot see this for a limit process, right?
Yeah, it looks fundamentally different.
We cannot take m.
You can't.
Zero.
Yeah.
And what's the reason of that we don't have this?
Well, it's sort of in a sense there's no limit in which the massless theory approaches the massless theory,
okay.
Because you can think about the degrees of freedom. There's no sense in which you can convert 3 degrees of freedom into 2. Okay. All right. So let me just pause here to write down the general rule. For a massless vector boson, when you sum over the polarizations, you replace this with minus eta mu nu. And then for a massive vector boson,
And you have the sum over polarizations. You replace this by minus eta mu nu plus k mu k nu over ma squared.
Okay, so this tells us, in effect, how to modify the propagator for a massive vector boson. So what I should write down is d mu nu is equal to minus I over k squared minus ma squared plus I epsilon. So this was the trivial way in which the propagator is modified. It shifts the pole, of course. So that's we didn't really discuss, but I think you can see that this is the case. But the non-trivial way is because of the sum over the polarization vectors. We should write down eta mu nu minus k mu k nu over ma squared. Okay. So this is the main problematic term that appears now. This k mu k nu over ma squared. It turns out that this term can spoil the renormalizability of the theory. So let's show that. So first, I'll just contrast it with what happens in QED. So just to remind you, you do have divergences, of course, in QED. They come into diagrams like this, and vertex diagrams like this. But it turns out, of course, that all of the divergences that appear can always be absorbed into redefinitions of the coupling constants, the electric charge, or the mass, or field strength, or normalization. But now for the massive QED-like theory, no longer the case. So let's consider, for the massive QED-like theory, a four-point function. So what I'm going to consider is psi scattering. And so, of course, we're going to look at it at one loop because you want to understand the divergences. And so let's think about a diagram like this, a box diagram. So here is psi. Here's psi like this. Okay. And in QED, it's finite. All right? Here, it's not going to be finite, as we'll see. So I'm only going to keep the terms that are going to be divergent in the limit that the momentum, the loop momentum, goes to infinity. Of course, because we're integrating over some loop momentum k. So let's write down schematically what this diagram would look like. So first of all, there are coupling constants here at every vertex. So I'll write that as g to the fourth. And then there's an integral over the loop momenta. So I should write d4k over 2 pi to the fourth. And I'm only going to integrate up to some cutoff, lambda. And so how this whole answer depends on lambda will tell me how divergent this diagram is. So I want to think about the terms that will be how the k dependence works in the limit that the integral approaches lambda. So I have two fermion propagators here. The leading k dependent part of the propagators will be like 1 over k slash squared. Now for the photons, the leading k-dependent part will come from this term here. All right. So in the limit that k goes to infinity, k over ma will be much larger than 1. Okay. And so I should write down just k mu k nu over k squared here. So I have k mu k nu over k squared, quantity squared. I'm not worrying too much about how the indices are contracted. It's just schematic. So now let's see how the k-dependence works. Here I have 1 over k squared. And this whole thing will effectively be finite as k goes to infinity. And so I'm integrating k cubed dk divided by k squared. We'll be integrating k dk up to some cutoff scale lambda. So this is like g to the fourth integral k dk up to some cutoff lambda. And so the whole thing will be like g to the fourth times lambda squared. So this is keeping only the leading divergent terms in the integral. So it looks like it's very divergent. So let me just write down, this is the momentum cutoff. Now, it's actually not as divergent as it appears. This leading divergence actually gets canceled out for a fairly trivial reason. If I include this diagram, I also have to include the same diagram, just where I attach the photon over here and this photon over here. OK, so you have to include, of course, all permutations. And so let me write down this one. So actually, this divergence cancels. I should be including this diagram plus this diagram. Now, how do you see that the divergence will cancel out? Well, so let's write down the k dependence in the loop. So let's say k goes like here. In this case, it'll be a little different. So k will go this direction and then down here. And then this way, and then up here. So the main difference is that here, the momentum is going the same direction along both fermion lines. Here, it's going in the opposite direction along both fermion lines. Okay? And so when I write down the Dirac propagator, I'll have k slash over k squared minus m psi squared. For this one, I'll have a minus k slash plus m psi over k squared minus m psi squared for that one.
Here I'll have k slash plus m psi over k squared minus m psi squared times the same thing. So because the k slash here is flipping sign between the two cases, this leading divergent term will end up canceling out. But you're still left with something log divergent. So here's how the divergence works. So you get something that's like g to the fourth. And so you can see that because the k slash part will end up canceling out, you'll just get the m psi squared part left over times something which goes like the log of the cutoff. I can write it as log cutoff squared. Not sure why I wrote it like that, but there you go. So you're still left with something divergent, and it depends on the couplings and the masses in this particular way. All right. So of course, the issue with having a divergent scattering diagram is that I need to introduce a coupling constant that absorbs the divergence. And it has to be a four-point coupling. So what you need to do is introduce dimension 6 term in the Lagrangian. To absorb the divergence. Not possible to absorb the divergence in the mass, or the field strength, or the charge, you'd have to write down a term in the Lagrangian, which was like some coupling constant, let's just call it C, and then psi bar psi, with some combination of Dirac matrices inside, whatever you get. All right. So now the total contribution to the scattering is something that you cannot predict, all right, because it depends on absorbing this divergence into this coupling constant. So unfortunately, the problem persists at higher orders as well. If you can try to compute higher point functions, you will always need to absorb higher dimensional operators in your Lagrangian to regularize and renormalize away these divergences. OK, so this is the problem. So that's the problem with saying that the theory might not be a gauge theory. Even if you totally abandon the hypothesis that the weak interaction is a gauge theory, you still run into these issues of having a predictive theory, which ultimately we want. So it turns out there is a way to form, in a predictive renormalizable theory, a theory with massive gauge bosons, and a theory with chiral couplings to fermions. And the way you do this, of course, is through what's called the Higgs mechanism, also known as spontaneous symmetry breaking. All right, so, so this will be the next topic. So the idea is that as we saw, you run into problems when you try to violate a symmetry at the fundamental Lagrangian level, if you just introduce by hand terms which violate the gauge symmetry. Even though you might have thought you're OK, you run into problems with renormalizability. However, you can have a theory which is ultimately symmetric with respect to the gauge symmetry, but the symmetry is broken spontaneously. The gauge symmetry can be broken spontaneously. Even if the Lagrangian is symmetric or invariant under the gauge symmetry. The way it's broken spontaneously, it just means that the state, the ground state, or the state with the lowest energy, is the one where the symmetry is broken compared to a high energy state where the symmetry is unbroken. So let me try to illustrate this in a kind of a simple context. So the basic idea is that we want our ground state, or the vacuum, to break the symmetry itself. All right. So let's let U be a symmetry transformation. And that leaves the Hamiltonian H invariant. So H goes to U, H U dagger, which is the same thing as H. And so, of course, this is what it means to have a theory in which the theory itself is invariant under a symmetry transformation. It respects the symmetry. So let's suppose we have two states. Which I'll just call A and B, that are related by the symmetry transformation. So I just mean if I take U acting on A, we get another state B. So in terms of creation operators, we have to have A is the creation of state A from the vacuum. And the state B, of course, is just the creation operator for state B acting on the vacuum as well. And in order for this property to hold, oh, hey.
I have to stop my lecture now.
Oh. Oh, okay.
Finish the thought.
No, it's okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, I forgot how long these things go. Oh, we can continue tomorrow. No problem.